Colectivo Raíces presenta su programa
Espejos de Aztlán.
Información,
arte,
cultura.
Bienvenidos.
We are with José Orduña, the author of The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement, and also assistant professor in the Department of English Language at the University of New Mexico. Welcome, José. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
First time when I read that there was a memoir, my first impression was, well, I'm going to meet an old person. I'm looking for a gray-haired person. And in this case, you're such a young author, and I was astonished and surprised by the content and the style of the writing. In this story, you have José, yourself, I guess, Yolanda, Martin, Octavio. I like Octavio's story, and it's the story of the life of immigrants in the United States. I was attracted by the title, The Weight of Shadows. What is that weight? Is it the weight of your parents' sacrifice to raise you and to be able to be in this country? And where are those shadows?
You know, the title was something that I came up with after I had finished writing the book. And it came from one of the chapters, specifically Disappearing Act. In Disappearing Act, I write about a painting by a Mexican painter named Remedios Varo. She painted something called Fenomeno, and the image is something that really intrigued me and that caused me to think about the situation of immigrants. The painting itself is an upright shadow. The shadow takes the place of where a body would be. And then there is the image of a flattened man that follows the shadow. So it's a kind of a switching of places. The man exists where the shadow once was, and the shadow walks upright where the body should be. And to me, it was a very apt metaphor to describe the situation of many immigrants here in the United States, and many people throughout Latin America. One of the ideas contained in that metaphor for me is that that there's something that happens to immigrants. There's something that happens where you are embodied, you are a person, but you're made to be no one. You are made to be shadow-like to the civic body.
Is that the story of Octavio? You have this character, Octavio, who sometimes is so lonely as well, making like a metaphor with Octavio Paz. Mm-hmm. Who is Octavio in this The Weight of Shadows book?
You know, Octavio is a character that I developed. And when I think about Octavio and I think about the robust life that Octavio leads, I think that he's someone who resists this this shadow-like nature. And I think there's... for me, the imposition of being shadow-like is something that people like Octavio resist. He lives his life. He exists as a person, and he asserts his personhood again and again and again. Octavio is, Octavio's story is one that I feel is very universal. Octavio's experience is similar to many other people's experiences, similar in many ways to my experience of finding yourself in a place that doesn't have a place for you.
The American Dream is many times in this book mentioned as the so-called American Dream. If it's not a dream, what is it?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are various ways that I resist this notion of the American Dream. I think the first way would be the first word, American. What does it mean to be American? Why does American mean North American? You know, for Mexicans, for other Latin Americans, when you say America, that doesn't mean the United States. That means an area far greater than the United States. So I resist that, first of all. And then I also resist the idea of the American dream being alive and well. There's a particular portion of the book where I go to the naturalization ceremony. I am naturalized. I'm made an American citizen through this swearing-in ceremony. And after the ceremony, I receive a form letter that says that I am proof that the American dream is alive and well. And, you know, I think that using, in many ways, my story can be cast as a success story. An immigrant who came and, you know, was able to get citizenship, and this proves that the American dream is alive and well. And I resist the notion that my experience and my story should serve as proof that the American system, the system by which people are granted citizenship, is working for anyone. So that's why I repeatedly sort of say the so-called American dream, so-called American dream. I think in many ways the American dream never existed. I think it's a fiction. And I think that it's a fiction that has been useful in many different ways, depending on which, you know, what historical period we're talking about. So I think it's always been a fiction. And I'm not sure what it means today.
Is that why when you are describing Yolanda and Martin in your story, you are in some part of your book, you're saying, I'm seeing them in the same place where they were when they arrived?
Yes, yeah. So
who are Yolanda and Martin?
Yolanda and Martin are my mother and my father. There's one portion where I talk about how they're in the same place that they were. And of course, you know, there are differences. You know, things are different, but I think that one of the great myths is that immigrants come to the United States seeking a better life, and they, you know, get a better life, and it's a happy story. I think that it's a lot more complicated than that. You know, immigrants don't just come to the United States seeking a better life. I think more broadly, one would have to think about and discuss why their lives are not good where they are. And when we look at the specific countries that send migrants to the United States, you know, Mexico, Central American countries, South American countries, time and time again, we see that many of the reasons that migrants come to the United States has a lot to do with either American foreign policy or different economic measures, you know, outright domination by certain corporations, time and time again. So I think that the notion that immigrants come to the United States seeking a better life, there's some truth to that, but it's important to see what happened before that and why people are needing to leave their country of origin.
We are this afternoon in Espejos de Aztlán with José Orduña, the author of The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement, and also assistant professor at UNM. And after this cut, we're going to ask him, what does he feel or his parents feel when when they are listening last Donald Trump's, Republican candidate Donald Trump, speeches regarding Mexicans? With José Orduña, assistant professor at the Department of English and Language and Literature at UNM, but this afternoon we want to share with you his last, just released, published book in April this year, The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement. When I was reading this book, how do your parents feel when you or them hear, they hear about last Republican candidate Donald Trump speeches, or particularly the one when he was running for Republican nomination, when he was describing Mexicans coming here, bringing drugs, bringing crime. What do you feel when you're listening to these kind of things?
I think that when Donald Trump came onto the scene as a candidate, the first thing I felt was that this is a circus. He's a clown. There's absolutely no way that this person is going to ascend in any sort of way. He's not going to be, you know, he's not going to be the candidate. This is an aberration. But, you know, I think that him ascending to the Republican candidate has opened a lot of people's eyes to just what state we are in the United States. So first I felt like he was a clown and it was laughable. Then I started to become a little bit more worried. And I am very worried about Donald Trump and the kind of rhetoric and the kind of incitement of violence that is part of his sort of rhetorical technique to mobilize his base. One of the things that I'm most worried about regarding Donald Trump is that he's such a horrendous person. He's such a horrendous candidate. He's so transparently racist and horrible that he kind of takes all of the attention, he takes all of the criticism, and we have on the opposite side of the aisle a candidate like Hillary Clinton, who is no friend of immigrants. And because Donald Trump is so horrendous, Hillary Clinton gets to kind of slide by saying, well, I'm not Donald Trump, so, you know, vote for me. I think one of the things that really scares me most about Trump is what he allows the Democratic candidate and the Democratic establishment to get away with. I mean, if you look at the immigration policy in this country, if you look at the mass deportations that have happened in this country, it hasn't been the Republicans. It hasn't only been the Republicans. There have been many, many Democrats that have been, you know, really virulently anti-immigrant in their policy and in their actual actions. They may be a bit friendlier in terms of their rhetoric. They may watch what they say a little bit more. But if you look at mass deportations, for example, Obama has broken records. If you look at the border militarization, that was something that began under Bill Clinton when he started Operation Gatekeeper, another Democratic president. So I think that, the thing that terrifies me most about Donald Trump is not only his base, his rhetoric, what would happen if he were elected, and I don't think he's going to be elected. I think it's going to be a landslide for Hillary Clinton. But one of the things that worries me most is he allows a sort of pass for the Democratic candidate and the Democratic establishment.
In your book, what I found very interesting is the way you intertwine American history, particularly regarding immigration, but also foreign policies, with personal stories. And I think that it's very interesting from the point of view of the reading, because it makes it attractive to read American history. You mentioned lots of facts and moments of this history. Can we highlight one that you think that was like a milestone in your parents' life that was really an important milestone in their story?
Yeah, you know, I think that if we're talking about just one particular instance, I think that for all Mexicans, it's the war with the Americans that redrew the U.S.-Mexico border, something that happened far before my parents were born, but it's something that continues to affect and that kind of set the tone for U.S.-Mexico relations. Half of Mexicans' landmass was essentially taken by the United States. and the boundary was redrawn. You know, entire states of the Southwest, this state, for example, used to be considered, it was part of Mexico. So I think that that's really emblematic of how the United States began operating as a country, and in many ways how it continues operating as a country. Certainly the methods and particularities have changed, have shifted, have adapted to this new political climate where outright invasion and occupation is now seen as bad. But I think that it's a similar tactics are still happening today.
You are listening to Espejos de Aztlán, and this afternoon we are interviewing José Orduña, the author of The Weight of Shadows, a memoir of immigration and displacement.
El hielo anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar.
We are with Professor José Orduña, or Professor José Orduña, author of The Weight of Shadows in Espejos de Aztlán. My name is Cristina Bachín, and we want to share with you this book. There are many things that I liked a lot. One of the ways you intertwine history and la vida cotidiana, everyday life, in this case, your own story, your parents and your family from Veracruz. When I read these kind of things, I always wonder, what does it mean, home, for people who are have been like in between worlds? ¿Qué significa para ti casa? What does it mean, home, for you?
Yeah, for me, the idea of home, una idea de un hogar, una casa, it's complicated. My own personal, my own personal history makes it in some ways complicated. I was born in Veracruz, and I came to the United States when I was 2 years old. So I don't remember anything at all about Veracruz. I came into awareness in Chicago, where I was raised. So the idea of home is for me. It's a little bit complicated. I think when a lot of people hear home, they think about a home country. And to me, I don't feel any fidelity to a country in terms of I strongly feel like I'm an American, or I strongly feel like I'm a Mexican. Of course, culturally speaking, I'm very much both. But in terms of nationality, to me, that's a very strange idea, the idea that one is defined by where one happens to be born. In many ways, you know, if you're talking about culturally, there are rich traditions, language that comes from your country of origin. But to be assigned a nationality, to be given a certain designation in terms of where one can go, where one can move, how one can try to make a life. That's very, very different to me than identifying as like culturally Mexican, but having an imposed boundary then put on you. It's very different. So I think for me, the idea of home is wherever I am, the people that I'm with, the relationships that I have, those things give me that feeling of home.
In your book, you describe that kind of weird feelings when you first went to visit your abuela. Can you tell us how was that encounter? How old were you?
I was about 9 or 10 years old, the first time that I met my grandmother. And you know, that's it was very strange. It was very strange to be taken home. You know, first of all, when my parents talk about home, it always means Veracruz. When they would talk to me about home, that always meant Veracruz. So when they took me home, it was a place that I had no memory of whatsoever. And when they presented me to my grandmother, she was essentially a stranger to me. And it was very strange. It was very strange to say this is to have someone say this is your grandmother, and to not be able to feel any of the things that one would think one would feel being around one's grandmother. And I think that's another imposition of this boundary line, of this border between countries. I never had the opportunity to know my grandmother until I was 9 years old. And at that point, I only began to get to know her a little bit, because of time that I spent there. But it wasn't really like a family relationship. So it was a very complicated and strange meeting. And I think that in many ways, you know, my parents were not really aware of that kind of complicated feeling that I had.
In your book, you use a lot of Spanish words. And as we were just talking, estábamos recién hablando en español. ¿Cuáles son tus palabras favoritas en español?
Mis palabras favoritas en español, pues... tengo unas palabras favoritas que, bueno, debo de explicar. Mi mamá tiene palabras favoritas en español, pero no sé, y muchas de las palabras que son sus favoritas son mis favoritas, pero no sé si las pueda decir en el radio.
Bueno, quizás en programa después de las 10. No estamos en ese horario.
Sí, sí.
Descarta esas.
Sí, sí. Pero pues, no sé, me gustan muchísimas palabras en español.
¿Cómo te llama tu mamá por teléfono?
Hijo mío, mi hijo, mi vida, Tatín. Uh-huh. Me dice Tatín porque... mi papá se llama Martín y a mí me pusieron el nombre José Martín, y cuando yo era pequeño, cuando trataba de decir Martín, decía Tatín. Entonces hasta hoy me dicen Tatín.
There is an interesting part of in your book where you use a very complicated social concept that was founded by the philosopher Jacques Derrida, deconstruction. But you use that word to describe a taco. What is a deconstructed taco?
Well, I that's still something I'm trying to figure out. I worked at a restaurant where they served very high-end sort of fine dining style Mexican food. And they had a thing that was a deconstructed taco. and essentially it was, you know, the various components that go into making a taco, but they were presented separately. You know, that can be very interesting to some people. To me, that was just, again, another fiction. And it's also, I don't think that there's any way that one can improve a taco. I think the taco is one of those things that is as perfect as it can get as a vehicle for food, and that it should be left alone and respected the way that it is. I like my tacos nice and simple, very traditional. Corn tortilla, I don't like flour. My favorite is either barbacoa or al pastor, cebolla, cilantro, maybe a little bit of salsa, and that's it.
That's a taco.
That's a taco. I'm not sure what a deconstructed taco is.
Yeah, I was curious about that. So if our listeners would like to go to your book, The Weight of Shadows, A Memoir of Immigration and Displacement, where can they find it and how can they get in contact with you?
Yes, my book is widely available at bookstores. Bookworks here in Albuquerque carries my book. You can also order it online directly from Beacon Press, which is the publisher of the book. But it's widely available. If you just Google the title, you should be able to find a vendor. And I encourage people to buy locally if they can. So wherever you are, go to your local bookstore. In Albuquerque, it would be Bookworks. Or visit your local public library and ask for it.
Thank you so much, Jose Orduña, and welcome home, because now this is where you are.
Thank you. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Jose.
Allá Malaya, la vida te costará solo por unas pitayas que en este monte no haya.
Vuela, 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 vuela sin parar, como quisiera ser agua de arroyo del Pedregal.
Vuela, 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 vuela voladora, me has de querer mañana, vámonos queriendo ahora. En la barranca pitaya y en los cerros se dan tuna.
En los cerros se dan tuna, en la barranca pitaya, en la barranca pitaya y en los cerros se dan tuna.
En los huecos de los palos anida la guacamaya. En los cerros se dan tunas y en la barranca pitaya.
En los huecos de los palos se anida la guacamaya. En los cerros se dan tuna y en la barranca pitaya.
Vuela, 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 como yo volé cuando me llevaron preso, señorita, por usted.
Vuela, 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 vuela voladora, me vas a querer mañana, vámonos queriendo ahora. Pobrecita guacamaya, y ay, qué lástima me das.
Se acabaron las pitayas y ahora sí que comerás. Pobrecita guacamaya, y ay, qué lástima me das.